This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Lindsay Clancy's murder trial is getting underway in Plymouth. Both sides agree that she took the lives of her three children. The only question is whether postpartum psychosis made her criminally responsible. That is the big question. And today we're going to do a big psychological breakdown of this case. Been very much looking forward to this. We're going to tackle it in three different lanes. We're going to talk first about what is postpartum psychosis, because it is different than postpartum depression. It's different than the baby blues. It's different than just turning a frown upside down. We're going to dive into that because that's the core of this case, and understanding the main core elements is rather important to decipher a case and work through it. Then we're going to talk about Lindsay Clancy herself, the clinical picture. What was going on with her specifically? We're going to dive into all that. And then also, why is it so hard, it seems, for the court system to understand mental health and the community as a whole to fully grasp this? And will a jury of 18 of her peers be able to come to a conclusion at the end of the day and a verdict? That is all in store for you today. We welcome your questions, your comments, all that in the comment section on Substack, YouTube, Facebook, X, wherever you're watching us. Please weigh in. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is who is with us to help us break this whole thing down, along with Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Let's start here. 80% of new mothers get some version of baby blues, if you will. That is, I'm going to say broadly, some version of it. 1 in 7 gets categorized into postpartum depression. 1 in 2 per 1,000 get psychosis. People treat those like the same condition if they don't quite understand it, like it's one with a different volume. In our interest of understanding psychosis, postpartum psychosis specifically, is psychosis even part of the spectrum of postpartum depression, or is it a completely different animal, Siobhan?
Absolutely different animal. Absolutely different. And this is one of the things I'm most passionate about, because psychosis runs in my family. Mm-hmm. And I have a very deep awareness and understanding of it, because it's something I've really focused on and studied for my entire career. And even years before I was a therapist as a kid, I was always trying to figure out, why is my aunt so weird, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a completely different animal. Baby blues is mainly caused by fatigue. You know how, if you've had a kid, you know how exhausted you are. You're not sleeping. You may be up most of the night. Breastfeeding takes a toll. The hormones are going crazy. And baby blues is completely normal. Now, when you move into postpartum depression, that's a deepening of, you know, it's a different quality to it. And that's when, I mean, most people have had episodes of depression, but this can be a very deep depression. And you want people to get help and support with that, because that may go on for months. You know, that baby blues is a short-term thing when you start getting the kid regulated and you're sleeping and breastfeeding is, you know, kind of been resolved and things are fine. It will self-correct. Mm-hmm. Postpartum depression, maybe not. They may need some therapy. They may need, you know, temporary, some kind of medication to help regulate their nervous system. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely something that can improve. Postpartum psychosis is a broken brain. It, completely different. It's not depression, although you can get depression with it. But psychosis is someone that's had a complete and utter break with reality. They're having delusions, false thoughts that can't be true. They're often having hallucinations, usually auditory hallucinations. And this can be very extreme, although I can talk about it for an hour, but I'll sort of intersperse as we talk here so I don't just give a lecture. Yeah. But one of the key points I want to make, because even people involved in true crime and very educated people don't understand the difference between psychopath and psychotic. And it's so important to understand, because we talk about these things. We throw these words out all the time. Psychopath is a personality type. It's a predator. It's someone with no conscience. And these are people that commit a lot of crimes. obviously, you know, a large percentage of the prison population is psychopathic. They're people we want to understand and watch out for. So we talk about those folks a lot in true crime. Psychotic can also be somebody that commits a crime, but the majority of people who are psychotic do not. But that's a brain disease. It's a symptom of something that's underlying, like schizophrenia, bipolar 1 disorder, and then there are a few other things that can cause it, but it's usually one or the other of those. And when you get psychosis postpartum, this is a Category 5 hurricane. This is an emergency because this person is no longer thinking in a rational, cogent way. They're not like the rest of us. And, you know, when you have that person taking care of a newborn and other young children, terrible things can happen. And that's what we're seeing here with this case.
Siobhan, I was looking this up when you said I didn't really realize that because, yeah, there's a huge difference between psychosis and psychopaths, huge difference. And I didn't really realize that it's actually genetic. It can be genetic and run in families. And actually, I just looked it up if it does run in her family, and there's no record of that yet. Do you think that's something that they would actually maybe try to look up and try to research to put into account when doing a defense of her? Would it be, have you seen that before? Maybe not.
It sure should be. I don't know that it often is done because, you know, the court system doesn't always seem to be interested in in-depth explanations for psychological processes, unfortunately, but highly heritable, highly genetic. And that's why on my mother's side of the family in particular, if you look, you can trace it down generations from an aunt to my aunt's daughters. Mm-hmm. I've got cousins who have struggled with it. My aunt ended up in a mental institution for, you know, multiple years near the end of her life, but went undiagnosed for most of her life throughout my childhood. Nobody ever diagnosed her. We said she was weird.
They're complete blips because everything else, you know, that I do and that we cover a lot of times are these arcs of behavior, and her arc of behavior is not this. And so those psychotic breaks really explain those away. You know, and we've said this before when dealing with psychopaths, no other species of any organism on this planet is sadistic or psychopathic. It's just us as humans. And this seems to be popping up that's very unique to us as a species on this planet as well. Genetically, I mean, I know it's a question that goes into genetics and our evolution and everything. Any idea why we actually have this trait that actually can pop up genetically for us? I mean, it just makes no sense in a way of survival or in procreation or anything why we'd have this trait that popped up.
Yeah, it really seems to be a flaw in humanity. And it's you know, people may speculate when it comes to psychopaths, some people say, well, they're useful, you know, because there are times you need in war, you need somebody who's brutal, who doesn't have a conscience. So evolution may favor psychopathy, you know, in some way. This is still being speculated about, that they have a use. But when it comes to psychosis, that kind of broken brain, I mean, it's sort of like a terrible disease like cancer, you know? It's like diabetes. It's like this flaw in the body, in this case, in the brain and the neurological system that absolutely ruins people's lives. It's just an insidious, insidious condition.
To help people understand, a psychopath, basically, personality type, you're born with it. That's who you are. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Psychotic brain disease, it can come on. It can be triggered by something and then come on. Can it also, I mean, if you get into that state, I think I know the answer to this, but I want your answer to it. You know, you can come out of it as well, correct? Mm-hmm. And when you come out of it, in obviously this will be conjecture, but when we're looking at Lindsay Clancy here, when she was able to come out of that state, is the person aware of what they did? Are they like, is there memories of those moments? But and you know, memory of these thoughts that at that moment in time made sense to her. But when you're out of the psychotic state, clearly you can see the error in your ways, to put it lightly.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful question because you see a lot of different patterns with it. And some people, when severely psychotic, don't remember what they did. Mm-hmm. most people do. They do are able, you're able to sit and talk with them. And sometimes it does sort of abate naturally. It seems like it was an episode, particularly bipolar 1 disorder, which is the type of bipolar where people do get very psychotic. That can come and go. It can ebb and flow. But most of the time with schizophrenia, the other one, they don't remit without treatment. You know, they really need psychiatric medication that can stop the hallucinations, stop the delusions, and bring them back to their baseline. Because most people, before they have a psychotic break, which can come on suddenly, they're perfectly normal. You would never look at them and think, this person is ultimately going to have a psychotic episode. There's not the warning signs that you see with many of the criminals we talk with, where you look at the behavior patterns over the lifespan and you can go back to, well, they were doing things as kids that were cruel and hurting animals and all that. With psychosis, it can come on most often in early adulthood, sometimes late teens, you start seeing some of the delusional things start, or the hallucinations. But it can come on at any time. It can come on in middle life, even in elderly folks. In elderly folks, another interesting bit is sometimes dementia can come along with psychosis, which is really a nightmare to manage.
What is it that brings it on in, what is it, 2 out of every 1,000, 1 or 2 out of every 1,000 women who go through a pregnancy, it's rare, much more rare than yeah. postpartum depression. But what is it that brings it on through that modality of being pregnant? Is it the hormone changes, yes. the ups and the downs and all that, and yes. then that already stimulate something that the brain already has, just kind of needed the key to be unlocked?
Yeah, a neuroscientist could probably give a more sure. in-depth explanation of what I can. But as I understand it, the tremendous hormonal shifts that happen in pregnancy, if you have a brain that's already sensitive mm-hmm. to this kind of change, that the hormonal changes along with the stress of having another child, particularly if you've got several other kids, this can cause this break to happen. Mm-hmm. So it's something we'll be studying for a long time and yeah. hopefully getting better at spotting it and monitoring what could be going on.
Yeah, and that's my question, Siobhan. So I was looking up, postpartum psychosis has been recognized for over 2,000 years. I mean, the Greeks had it recognized. I mean, this has been around for a long time. It was included in DSM a number of years ago, obviously. Are we getting better at recognizing this, or are we ignoring it? I mean, it's kind of shocking that, because I was expecting this to actually just be a recent thing that we started recognizing as we've gotten more advanced, as we've, you know, not stigmatized mental health. Maybe this is kind of a new thing, but it's not a new thing. Just look, Google it and you'll see, oh my God, how come we're not doing better at this right now?
We're doing, as an entire society, we are doing a shit poor job of understanding mental health and understanding mental illness in every type of mental illness. I I'm online a lot and I'm monitoring the chatter and people are still saying demon possession. A lot of people are saying they're hearing the voices of demons. And it just makes me absolutely crazy because I did hear that in my religious childhood upbringing. Yep. These people are all demon possessed. We've got to pray it away. Guess what? Doesn't work. That's how people get killed. Yeah. So we've got to keep educating, which is why I appreciate you guys and what we try to do on this show so much, because that's what it's about. We can't solve problems when we're ignorant about yes. what causes it and what it looks like. And we've got to try to educate people. But Amen. Families also, you know, I have had in my 30 plus year, I hate to say how many years because it really dates me, but I'll say 30 plus years of practice, I have had one case of postpartum psychosis and it terrified me because of the woman being home alone with the baby. The family was blowing it off. They were saying she's just stressed. She's always been a little anxious. She's having some anxiety. It was psychosis. And I could see it very clearly. Her OB didn't see it. And the family was leaving her home alone with the baby all day. So
what what allowed you to see it and other people were going along the life arc that she gave, you know, because, you know, Lindsay's a great example of this. When you first do that deep dive, her background, who she was, the type of wife, the type of mother, the type of daughter, the type of nurse, it gives that arc of nothing to worry about here. But what allowed you to see it in that other case that the others weren't? Because I'm guessing it's probably very similar in a lot of that respect.
She came in crisis, and she was a former client that I hadn't seen since her pregnancy. And I got a crisis call from her, and I was able to...
And I'm sorry, Siobhan, let me interrupt. What's a crisis call to you?
When somebody calls really agitated, and I hear in their voice, we've got to change here. You know, we've got something different. And she was very upset. She wanted to come in and talk to me. And... as they say, I'm really tuned into psychosis, and not all therapists are. So I think even, you know, people who are fairly good therapists, it's just not their area of interest, so they don't study it. I think therapists miss it a lot of the time, which is a tragedy. They've got to do better. You know, we've got to hold them accountable for paying more attention. But in talking with her for an hour, I knew what questions to ask and how to really get into, okay, what's the thinking processing going on here, which the family wasn't really doing that. And they were just saying, oh, she's always been anxious, you know, so she's just having anxiety. And then going on with their day, because they also had an investment in not wanting her to be their term crazy. They didn't want her to be crazy. Very proud family, very educated people, and they were above that sort of thing. So I ended up, I was so alarmed. She was at home alone with the baby. She didn't feel safe at home alone with the baby. She was telling people that. They weren't listening to her. So I called her husband, got her consent, and she agreed. Called her husband from work and said, you need to come into my office. I canceled the following person because, you know, sometimes you have to do that and say, I have to reschedule you because there's a crisis. I called both her parents to come in and her sister to come in. And I tried to get through to them, this is not okay. She needs to be in a hospital. And then it was quite an ordeal because we lived in a community in California that did not have a private psychiatric hospital. And even though she was well insured, you call around to try to find a psychiatrist to see somebody in case of emergency. New clients, a wait of 6 months.
Ha!
Right? Or, and this is the norm in the country. This is a standard throughout America. You know, I wrote a number down, 40% of people in the U.S. live in a federally designated mental health shortage area where there just aren't people. We have a terrible shortage of psychiatrists. And this is the kind of thing, we shouldn't put this on the obstetrician to manage, you know, or the...
And one of the things in this case, yeah, I mean, the mental health desert, what, you know, and I will say this, thank God this exists. I mean, the fact that we now have online therapy, that does certainly help some of the mental health deserts that used to exist. But still physically, they do exist, but it I guess it's better than nothing. And we've had, you know, those supporters over the years. I Lindsay's providers allegedly charted intrusive thoughts when she described a male voice commanding her to hurt her children. Is that an intrusive thought or something else completely different that should have been handled and looked at for the weight that it was?
Completely different. And that's a clinical failure. Were they not listening well enough? Were they not asking the right questions? Was it a 15-minute check-in visit, you know, what was going on? Because intrusive thoughts, a lot of us have had some intrusive thoughts. It can go with major depression, you know, and that's along the lines of, I just screw everything up all the time. I'm a loser. I can't get a good job. You know, they're unpleasant. You recognize them as, this is a thought I'd rather not be having. But it can also go along. So major depression can cause it. OCD can cause it. I'm really worried about insects in my food. Oh, no, I have to look carefully. Well, right now I have to wash my lettuce really carefully because there could be something in my lettuce. And so they think about it too much. But it's not severe in the same sense of I am literally hearing voices in my head that are telling me things that are completely bizarre and can't be true. And the thing with the psychotic symptoms, the delusional thinking, the person doesn't realize that this is unreasonable. You know, it's right. They fully, completely believe it.
Siobhan, the other thing that you keep referring to, asking the right questions, you ask the right questions, you think, I don't want to throw conjecture on it, but you're wondering what questions her therapist asked. Are there specific questions for people that are going through this now or fearful of this now? Is there anything that the type of question you can ask that might be a bit of a wobble that might say, all right, we need to pay closer attention to this, or is it really situational?
It is situational, but I think the key thing is you have to spend enough time with the person to get their internal experience. And, they may not be disclosing of it. So they have to trust you enough to disclose it. So it's really spending that quality time, gaining their trust, and then really asking the things. If they say, well, I'm just feeling upset, I'm not sleeping. Okay, you have to go beyond that. Tell me what goes on in your head when you're not able to sleep. Or they may say, I'm having anxiety. Tell me the thoughts that are behind the anxiety. And so it really takes, let's just go deeper. Let's go deeper. Yeah. Let's go deeper. Right. And sometimes family members, they don't know how to do that. So it takes some presence and skill to be able to go deeper.
Well, and it seems sometimes clinicians don't either. We're gonna get into that here in just a second. That's what postpartum psychosis is as a condition. Now, let's talk about what actually was happening to Lindsay Clancy. And as we do, put your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to continue to weigh in.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Lindsay Clancy, that's the case we are talking about today, because she did everything the system tells a struggling mother to do when they're feeling that something is off, very off. She didn't just sit there and go, this is me, deal with it. She went to ERs. She called crisis lines. She checked herself into hospitals who checked her out, took every pill they handed her, and the system kept handing her more and then handed her back. And now she's on trial for taking the lives of her three children after going through that horrific ordeal. We welcome your thoughts in the comment section. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is with us, along with Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. 13 medications in 4 months. That's the big thing that stands out to me on this whole damn case and just kind of ends it all. Benzos, antidepressants, antipsychotic, a sedative. Her husband told the doctors she was turning into a zombie. At 13 drugs, whether you just had a baby or not, and you're getting on all these different medications this frequently, and one doctor's not talking to the next and communicating what one is on, what may interact this way with that one. Is anyone still actually treating the patient, or are they just kind of handing out TikToks at the behest of Big Pharma? I mean, what exactly is going on here when you have a situation exactly like Lindsay Clancy's?
Yeah, this is a systemic failure, and I hesitate to lay blame, although I might. I would love in this case to look over all the treatment notes and all the rationales, because when they change a medication, they're supposed to have a rationale for why. Did they in this case? And if they didn't, then that's a flag of a bad doctor. But, I wonder how much time were they spending? Were these 15-minute appointments? I mean, one of the problems here with the system is insurance doesn't cover hour-long visits for psychiatry. It's supposed to be a quick med check, mm-hmm. so they start a med. Were they following up? When you start a med with somebody who's this ill, you want to follow up in a few days, at most a week. You don't want to say, I'll see you next month. And there's no excuse for lacking the coordination of care. Providers need to talk to anyone else who's treating that person. Because, yeah, we really, at this point, it sounds horrible. It's confusing. It obviously, this was not effective treatment.
Yeah.
And it really needs to be, you know, the deconstruction of this whole thing. And who was not paying close attention.
And it sounds pretty par for the course in how we handle prescribing most of these medications in our country. I mean, psychiatrists should be the ones that are prescribing it, but yes. You have so many general cares that just yes. do because somebody comes in and says, I'm feeling down. Well, let's see what we got in the sample cabinet over here today for you. 17-minute appointments. I mean, if anyone, our audience out there who's takes any of these things, it may have been in those situations where it's like, wow, that was a really quick exam to give me drugs that can mm-hmm. dramatically alter my thinking. Mm-hmm. That's always been disturbing to me, but it is unfortunately the norm, which mm-hmm. I'm going to guess you would agree needs to change. Each one of those short psychiatric appointments ended with a new prescription. And it wasn't all psychiatrists that were handing out the Tic Tacs. Nobody stopped to ask whether the first 12 had done anything except make her worse. Is that a failure of the doctor? Is that what basically 17-minute appointments are designed to produce?
Yeah, I have known a handful of wonderful psychiatrists. So
sure.
There are some that really follow up closely. They coordinate care. If the person has a psychotherapist who they're doing talk therapy with, they talk with that person. They really try to clarify diagnosis. So I don't want to say it's all of them.
No, not at all.
But in a lot of cases, there's a tremendous pressure for them to see a lot of people because of the doctor shortage. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like people are being churned and you know, pushed through the system, and there's not the time for the follow-up care. And, you know, is the doctor working in a hospital setting or a group which is demanding that they practice that way? I don't think most doctors are well-meaning, but there's sure. this pressure in the system to churn people through.
Yeah, and I want to get to the system here, because while we're discussing this, I'm like, all right, so we're talking about mental health and we're talking about psychiatrists and we're going glass half full, great psychiatrists out there. But if they're limited because of the amount of time they can spend there, what's causing it? And so I did look up in general how our insurance system is covering psychiatry. So No, it's not. So here's the bottom line. So the co-pays, you generally pay the specialist. So they regard psychiatrists not as primary care. They regard them as specialists. So you need a specialist referral. They have co-pays are higher. Deductibles and co-insurance are higher. Most of them are out of network. And so your insurance is not going to cover it all anyway. Prior authorization is required. The visits are limited in the numbers you get. And network adequacy, medication management, and therapy is reduced. And so all these hindrances to want to get good mental health is a big problem in this entire thing.
Yeah. Yeah, you nailed it. Very, very true. And the other thing that I think is a good standard of care is the psychiatrist, particularly someone with postpartum psychosis with an infant, they need to be talking to family members as well. And
yes.
of course, you have to have a release to do that. But whenever I have somebody that I think is very unstable or I'm worried about, you know, something bad could happen here, I get a release to talk to family members because they are spending, hopefully, a lot of time with that person, and they may be noticing odd behaviors that person is not disclosing.
Yes.
And so that's something that I think is rarely done. But again, the time, you know, it's a collateral visit. Sometimes you can just have a phone call with the mother or the father or the husband and say, hey, you know, I'm a little concerned about this and that. What are you noticing at home? It's another important thing.
I want to talk about her husband recognizing the problems here, because he was on her side helping her get to appointments, you know, monitoring this, telling doctors this isn't working. He was very involved. And there's some people who've kind of gone down a road of like, well, he shouldn't have gone on for takeout. Okay, well, I'm sure he looks back on that and goes, bad choice.
Same thing.
But it's not like he wasn't giving a shit. Yeah. He was there. He still is there for her. An interesting element to this case is that allegedly in a previous pregnancy, she had postpartum depression, not postpartum psychosis, at least wasn't diagnosed as postpartum psychosis. So there is a bit of a history here. And if you've gone through that once, if you're the partner of the person who's gone through it, or even if you're the person, if you're her, and you're feeling somewhat similar in certain ways, but different nonetheless, to the partner, that may be presenting as, okay, she's going through postpartum depression again. Okay, sure, we got this. We did it before. It's difficult. It's shitty. I feel horrible for her, but we got this.
Yeah.
It's as the partner of someone, it would be very easy, in my summation, to not be able to distinguish the two. Number one, he's not a medical provider. Yeah. He's the husband. All of these doctors couldn't quite seem to figure it out. And I wouldn't expect him to either. But how easy is that for someone in a situation like this with multiple children who've had difficulty in the past with postpartum depression to just think, oh, it's that again?
Yeah, very, very easy. Very easy. And I think families do that all the time. They don't have the training to recognize it. And I'm guessing from everything we've heard that he had no idea that she would ever hurt the children. That just is so unfathomable, you know, that it just didn't cross his mind that was a possibility.
Siobhan, another thing that it popped up in a little bit in this case earlier, and then the example you gave, where a lot of times it sounds like, again, we just have a limited data set here, that there's a lot of self-awareness that this person knows that they're having a problem, they're having an issue, they actually reach out to people. Is it more or less common for a level of self-awareness to have someone like Lindsay know that they're having an issue and go seek help on their own, or do they try to hide it more often than not?
I think that's an excellent point because, you know, with her medical background and knowledge, she probably had more insight than most psychotic people do. And sometimes, you know, they try to minimize it. They try to hide it. They find it confusing, shameful, hard to figure out. And so they just try to keep plugging away. And as the symptoms intensify, other people may or may not notice it. And somebody may reach out to get help for them, even when they don't understand what it is, you know, but that's the important
thing.
And
it's easy to dismiss it. We kind of talked about it a little bit already too, just because when you're a healthy person in general, you're surrounded by good, healthy relationships, people figure you got it. And then also, you know, my daughter being a nurse, as I brought up multiple times, believe it or not, they don't have the best health coverage. You know, they're in the same marketplace competing with everyone else. And a lot of times they don't have the best health coverage. And so you have people that are surrounding you saying, we got this, we're loving, good, caring family, and we're only allowed 15-minute visits, and we're out of copays, and you know, so it makes it easy to rationalize away. So I'm not saying he did, it's just the system, like we keep saying, was not structured to take care of people in distress.
Not at all. I'd like you to explain, Siobhan, to people who have the question here, where they cite, which the prosecution is saying, she was coherent the day that this all went down. Pediatrician visit, allegedly played in the snow, ordered takeout. See, she's with it. Explain to people who don't quite understand how someone can be in a full, could have a full psychotic break and still be presenting completely normal to people around them on that very same day.
Yeah. Great question. And the interesting thing is, if they knew what was going on internally for her, they would have got it. But she was not necessarily disclosing that to them, not disclosing much about it. And that's common for people with psychosis to present fairly normally. They can get up in the morning, they can shower, they can make food. You know, they may seem that they're doing their normal routine, but it's what's going on in their head that's different. And the family may be picking up on small things that are different, but as you say, just kind of minimizing it. Oh, she's depressed again or whatever. But it's very possible for people to have some degree of strategic planning to know what they're doing. I mean, so many cases come to mind, but the guy who shot Gabby Giffords, he was going to college. You know, people thought he was weird. He was doing weird things, but he was functional in many ways and yet completely delusional about, you know, that she was doing things to him or whatever, but he wasn't telling people about all the delusions. And so he navigated well. He was even stopped on the way to because he did kill people. He was stopped on the way to the murders by a police officer. The cop interviewed him. He said he was very polite. He shook hands with him and had no idea that there were guns in the trunk, you know. So
to that, Siobhan, because again, I think it's important for people to really understand what this looks like to the layperson kind of crossing their path in these things. And correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm kind of taking a wild ass guess at this. As you've described psychosis, is it basically like this as it presents? Is like this person is completely living their normal reactions. They're living their normal life. The psychosis part is like added in. In other words, they don't change who they are. They don't change all the behaviors. They just have this added thing because the psychotic event is being added to them, which is unrecognizable potentially to others because they're presenting in normal because it is normal to them. They just have this added thing that just popped in their head, like voices, images, whatever it is. Is that correct?
It can be. And the other thing that I think is poorly understood is that psychotic symptoms can be on a continuum. And you can have people who are a little bit psychotic. I've got, disclose, I don't think she watches this show, a cousin who...
We'll
call her a cousin. Yeah. She believes that dead people talk to her.
Oh.
And yes.
Seems rational.
And,
they have whole TV channels around that.
Yeah. And she does channel. She does channeling.
Okay.
And, you know, tries to talk about being a medium. But it's caused it caused her marriage to end. It's caused lots of problems for her in her life. And if you spend time talking to her, she's very mentally ill. I mean, I picked it up right away.
Yeah.
She's in college right now. She's doing well. She's doing internships out in the community. She's just not talking about the dead people talking to her. Now, that's on one end of the continuum, somebody that can function pretty well. On the other end, and all gradations in between, but on the other end, I have gone out with Mobile Crisis to evaluate people who were literally so psychotic. One guy was sitting on the couch and could not get up to find the kitchen to feed himself. His thinking was so disorganized. The voices were going constantly. Anybody would look at him and go, psychotic. But it's, you know, it's different in different people.
So I'm also curious because I've seen, you know, the pseudoscience shows that cover this kind of thing. And I'm curious. So when people are having one of those moments where, so let's use, for example, your person we're calling a cousin,
yeah.
She's at the moment, she is thinking she's channeling someone who's passed and deceased, which is a psychotic moment. Is something different going on in the brain at that time that is recordable, that's actually recognizable?
That would be fascinating to know. And my guess is very likely so, but I don't think we have enough, you know, sophisticated neuroscience monitoring and screening to be able to know that.
They've
sure.
done it on Long Island Medium. I saw that one episode once where they actually wired her brain up to see what was going on during her events. And that, I was curious whether that was a one-off or whether there's actually been any studies on psychotic
events.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do think it has been to a certain degree. I do think so. But yeah, it's at times when they have studied at times when the voices are happening, the auditory parts of the brain
right.
are actually lighting up. They are hearing that. And yes, with the more subtle kinds of delusional things where, yeah, I'm hearing, you know, my dead grandma talking to me or whatever. would that, or, you know, and some of hers is just delusional. She's not always hearing the voices, but she's having the thoughts and believing that the dead people are communicating.
See, Tony, little did you know you're getting content for ghost stories as well.
That's true.
I was thinking about that.
I mean, yeah, I hear you. I mean, yeah. And that's a whole other conversation over there.
It's a deep conversation. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, with true crime and the ghost stories used to be spooky when I do those. Now it's just like, oh, this is such a nice relief from
worlds colliding,
release
Tony.
from the real monsters of the world, the humans. Let's talk about the five providers across multiple facilities. There's a civil lawsuit that the family filed that she and her husband filed against them. None of them pulled a complete history or talked to each other. I think the process or the thought process for most Americans is that if I'm getting a prescription from my doctor, they have a magical system that communicates with the previous doctors and they know what I'm on, or I've told them what I'm on, and they're going to do their due diligence and make sure that because they're the last line of defense here, other than the patient themselves, of making sure I'm not taking something that's going to be dangerous for me. None of that occurred. Why is that? Is the system not designed for this, not required to do these sort of things? It's just kind of on an honor basis. What failed here so catastrophically, or is it working as designed?
No. Our ethical standard of care, and in order to get a license, a clinical license, it is mandatory that you understand if there are other providers treating the person, including a family practitioner, you are supposed to be communicating with the other providers. If they have a talk therapist, the psychiatrist is supposed to coordinate care with that person to find out what they're seeing. Certainly providers providing different meds are supposed to be communicating with each other. In most cases, that's discouraged. It's like, get one good provider and stick with that person. You know, don't hop around. But I find it a matter of most likely a fatigue on the part of the providers, the overwhelm, the fact that they're just not following standard of care because they don't have the time and energy to do it, which is
Are there any consequences for not, other than getting sued?
Getting sued, and certainly reports to licensing boards can be made, and you can get dinged that way. Now, is the licensing board going to take action in every case? You know, certainly if there's a bad outcome like this, I would think that they would at least be reprimanded.
Yeah, that's why I just looked up standard of care, HIPAA, liability risk, and professional guidelines all require them to communicate like that.
Yes. Absolutely.
It's one of these cases where hopefully this is a cautionary tale for some offices, and that this, you know, indirectly we'll never necessarily know about it, but enough will go, shit. Let's really watch this.
Definitely.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube on that portion of our conversation as we continue talking about the Lindsay Clancy case.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.